Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, personal identity. We'll start by figuring out what philosophers mean by the phrase personal identity and why they think there is such a thing.
Next, we'll look at some examples of personal identity, especially the puzzling cases, some real, like multiple personalities or Alzheimer's, and some imaginary, like brain transplants. Then we'll look at people's intuitive judgments about these cases and see if that helps us figure out what personal identity is.
And finally, we'll look at the implications of theories of personal identity for issues about rationality and morality.
You know, Ken, the term personal identity doesn't just belong to philosophers, unfortunately, I guess. People actually may be more familiar with the way psychologists tend to use the phrase.
Well, I think I know what philosophers mean by identity. Identity means there's just one thing. If you got two things, A and B, and they're identical, well, then there really aren't two of them, there's just one of them. So, Ken Taylor and Professor Taylor. There aren't two people there, there's just one. George Bush, Laura's husband. Not two people, but one person. Identity is just that, identity. And when it's personal identity, it's when the objects involved are persons rather than anything else. What else could we mean by personal identity?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right, but most people commonly do mean something else by it. A person's identity is the attributes they have, or at least believe themselves to have, that are most important to them. Take Mike Huckabee, the Republican presidential candidate, for example. He says that being a Christian is part of who he is, part of his identity. It defines him. That's the sense in which people might say that it's part of his identity, while for someone else, being a Christian might not be such a big deal. He might easily think of himself as a Hindu or an atheist.
I mean, I see what you mean, but that's quite a different use of personal identity in the philosophical sense. I mean, suppose Mike Huckabee goes through a rough patch. He loses his faith, plunges into alcohol and crime, becomes a free thinker or maybe even an atheist, lands in prison, and then eventually, when he becomes president, converts to being a Democrat. His voters might be upset. He clearly would have changed his identity in the psychological sense, but we philosophers would say, what's the big deal? It's one and the same person who was once a Republican Christian and is now a Democratic atheist. That's what makes it interesting, really. It's just one person, this very same person, who undergoes these surprising and significant changes.
Well, we had something like that happen, didn't we? I mean, we elected this guy Bill Clinton, who seemed to be this very chaste, married guy, faithful to his wife, and then somewhere along the second term, he became a skirt-chasing roué. Maybe I don't have my facts quite right.
Yeah, I think he was always like that.
But here's the puzzle. Suppose Mike Huckabee and Barack Obama are sharing a cab to the airport. There's a horrible accident. They both have grievous head injuries. Their brains are removed from their skulls so they can be patched up. Then the brains are put back in the skulls, but they get it wrong. The surgeons screw up. They put Huckabee's brain back into the body that was Obama's and vice versa.
Yeah, and then we have two people waking up. One looks outwardly like an African-American, but he's claiming to be a white Republican from Arkansas. The other looks outwardly like a middle-aged white guy, but he claims to be a black Democrat from Illinois.
Right, but who are they really? One answer is that the black guy is still Barack Obama, the white guy is still Huckabee, but they have each undergone a tremendous change in personality involving amnesia and delusions about their past. Identity in the philosophical sense, but not in the psychological sense.
Or we could say that we have two guys with their memories and personalities pretty much intact. The accident didn't do anything to that, but they just have changed bodies.
Okay, so which is it?
It's medically impossible.
That's a cop-out. But maybe our expert guest, Raymond Martin from Union College, can help us come up with an answer.
Yes, but first it's our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, who cast about for some insights into how to understand personal identity. She files this report.
I wanted to come up with a weighty rumination on the nature of personal identity. Then I realized Hollywood had already done it for me. For example, the 1999 Spike Jonze movie Being John Malkovich, written by Charlie Kaufman, tells the story of a hapless puppeteer fascinated by the idea of getting out of his own head.
Perhaps it's the idea of becoming someone else for a little while, being inside another skin, thinking differently, moving differently, feeling differently.
He succeeds, literally, when he discovers a portal that leads directly into the brain of actor John Malkovich.
I mean, it raises all sorts of philosophical type questions, you know, about the nature of self, about the existence of a soul, you know? Am I me? Is Malkovich Malkovich? Do you see what a metaphysical can of worms this portal is?
The film's protagonists decide to cash in on the phenomenon, selling tickets for the opportunity to spend 15 minutes inside Malkovich. From there, the movie descends into a bizarre, semi-fantastical dreamscape. But the point remains, it raises deep questions about the nature of the self. Besides wondering whether it's possible to become someone else, the film world has also asked whether our bodies and brains define who we are. In Freaky Friday, both the original 1976 version and this remake with Lindsay Lohan, a mother and daughter come to understand each other better after magically switching bodies.
What are you?
It's me, Mom.
You're not my mother.
Yes, I am.
Get away, you clone freak!
Don't you use that tone with me.
Oh my God, you are my mother.
Following on the theme of brain exchange, the 1974 Mel Brooks flick Young Frankenstein famously taught us that the quality of your brain is crucially important in determining your personality.
Would you mind telling me whose brain I did put in?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
Abby someone.
Abby who?
Abby Normal.
Abby Normal. Are you saying that I put an abnormal brain into a 7.5 foot long, 54 inch wide gorilla?
All of these films seem to suggest identity is malleable to the extent that we can alter our brains. Fortunately, the wonders of modern science have so far stopped short of the full brain transplant, but who's to say it won't happen someday? Now, on the other hand, let's say your body and brain are perfectly intact, but one day you discover you've got a double with exactly the same genes, same memories, everything. This question was handled elegantly in the 150th episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Through a fluke in the beamer upper, or whatever it's called, Trekkies, forgive me, an extra copy of Commander Riker gets abandoned on an alien planet for 8 years until the Enterprise comes back and finds him again. Trouble ensues.
Who are you? Who are you? I'm Commander William Riker from the Federation Starship Enterprise. It's not possible. I'm Will Riker.
Inevitably, because it's TV, this episode wraps up with everyone pretty much happy. The copy of Riker goes off to a new job on a different ship, and the original Riker gets to keep his life the way it is. But the important question here is either one of them more authentically Riker than the other one?
Good luck, Will. I actually thought I might go with the name Thomas.
Your middle name.
I guess we really are different. I never really cared for that name. Well, I sort of like it.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Cornelli.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Raymond Martin. He's professor of philosophy from Union College, author of The Rise and Fall of Soul and Self, an intellectual history of personal identity. Ray, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. Thanks, Ken. Hi, John.
Hi, Ray. So tell me, how did you become interested in this strange topic of personal identity? Did you have some identity crisis in your youth that you never recovered from?
No, maybe I watched too many of those shows that you just excerpted from. But the real reason was a 1971 article by Derek Parfit, which appeared in Phil Review, called Personal Identity, which changed the complexion of the traditional problem in ways that really intrigued me.
Tell us about how you got intrigued. What intrigued you so much?
Well, what it was the separation of the question of whether or not a person in the future is you with the question whether or not the person in the future realizes what matters to you and your selfish concern for your own survival.
So it might be pretty clear cut that the guy that's going to retire and use my retirement is me. But maybe it's a separate question whether he has my values and whether I should really care about him. Is that the idea?
Well, that's one of the possibilities. The other is that the person won't be you, but you are selfishly concerned with his welfare.
Mm-hmm. You guys got to help me. You guys, there's a lot of stuff going on here. So, okay, here I am planning for my future, right? And, well, let's go back 30 years. There I was planning for my future when I was a young guy.
Right.
Right? And it's thinking, someday I'm going to be an old guy.
Right.
And I asked, why should I care about that old guy who's going to exist in 2020 or something?
Right. Each month, the equivalent of a car payment on a fairly decent car is taken from your salary.
Right.
For the benefit of some old geezer that you probably won't even like.
Yeah, right.
Or wouldn't even like.
Wouldn't like if I saw him. Gosh, such a crotchety old geezer. Right. And so, Ray, the answer to the question, why should I care about that old guy in the future who's going to be this crotchety old geezer, is because that old geezer is me. It's me later. Right. But you're saying Parfit somehow said, I mean, look, the answer to why I should care is it's me. It's identical with me, just a later version of myself. And you're saying somehow Parfit separated these things? How could those possibly be separated?
Well, take your example with which you began with Obama and Huckabee. And just imagine that before the brain transplant, you know, each of them was given the opportunity of making significant sacrifice in order to improve the welfare of the person after the transplant, or one of the two people after the transplant. And suppose they learned in advance that one of them was going to be suffused with pleasure after the transplant and one of them was going to suffer a horrible pain. So if they were both merely motivated by selfishness, who should they want? Which survivor should they want to get the pleasure and which survivor should they want to get the pain?
So let me see, make sure I understand it. So suppose we change the example so that for some reason, let's say that the guy in Obama's body knows that Huckabee's brain is going to be transplanted in. Mm-hmm. And you go to him and you say, look, could you take these Advil? Because the guy, you know, when this guy wakes up tomorrow with your body and Huckabee's brain, he's going to have a horrible headache. And if you would take some Advil, get it going in your system, it would really be diminished. And the guy in Obama's body says, well, I will if it's going to be me, but I won't if it's not going to be me because Advil gives me a stomachache. Now, that seems like a reasonable question. What's the answer?
Absolutely.
And they might say, well, you know, the doctor might say, we have to wait for the Supreme Court to decide, or we have to wait for the American Philosophical Association to decide. That doesn't seem reasonable.
Well,
there ought to be an answer.
We got Ray Martin to give us the answer. What's the answer, Ray?
I would save the pain for the person who is going to get my brain and psychology. But whether or not there is actually an answer is like a separate question, I think.
Let's separate the question whether there is an answer. We know what your answer is. You go for what's sometimes called a psychological theory or psychological criterion of personal identity. Identity goes with the memories, not with the body. Do I have you right?
Well, there is, in that case, a physical component, too. I mean, a portion of the brain or the brain as a whole is transplanted along with the psychology. So it's not a pure psychological continuity account, but if there were that much bodily continuity and the psychology, I would go with that.
Well, we're gonna challenge you and dig deeper into this in a minute. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're discussing personal identity with Raymond Martin from Union College.
How do you define personal identity? By someone's job, but then if they change job, it'd be a different person. That doesn't make any sense. Where they were born, that never changes. The clothes they wear, When you interact with someone, does their past influence how you treat them, the whole identity, the whole accumulation of things they've done? Or do you consider just who it is in the moment? Is that all that really matters? Let us know by calling toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. That'll work anywhere in the continental U.S., if you're calling from the moon, please shout.
Puzzles about personal identity, plus your calls and emails, when Philosophy Talk continues.
This holiday season, the gift of thought.
The complete Philosophy Talk is now available.
All 147 programs can be yours.
Every purchase helps keep Philosophy Talk on the air.
Details at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Mm-hmm.
the street, he says, why am I short of attention? Got a short little span of attention, and all my nights are so long. Where's my wife and family? What if I die here? Who'll be my role model now that my role model is gone, gone? He ducked back down the alley with some roly-poly little bat-faced girl. All along, along, there were incidents and accidents. There were hints and allegations. If you be my bodyguard, I can be your long-lost pal. I can call you daddy.
You can call me John Perry.
And my identity is Ken Taylor. It's Philosophy Talk, and we're discussing issues of personal identity.
How can you imagine yourself changing? Can you imagine yourself changing so much that although in an official sense it's still you, you really wouldn't care anymore? Can you imagine yourself changing in such a way that you wouldn't want to save for your own retirement if you were going to be such a person? Tell us what you think. The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Raymond Martin from Union College. Ray, just to sum up a little bit what we said before I ask you another question. So okay. It looks like we got two things, right? We've got the body. So we had that Barack Obama Huckabee thing where we thought, are they switching bodies? Are they switching selves? Are they? Well, you might think they're switching bodies. They're switching brains. The brain switch means a self switch. The body switch means where do I go? Where my body goes or where my mind goes? I mean, that's one kind of question, right? Where, right. And what's your? I wasn't clear about what your thought was. Do I go where my body goes, or do I go where my mind, my brain, my consciousness goes, and why? One or the other.
Well, I would say in a case where enough of your body goes to carry your full psychology, and your psychology, of course, goes with it, then my sympathies go with that person who's on the receiving end of that. I can understand somebody saying that the body remains the original person, but I personally wouldn't be that concerned with the fate of the body if the brain and the psychology went in a different direction.
Okay, so let's change it a little bit. Suppose you make a copy of a molecule for molecule copy of Huckabee's brain and put it in Obama's skull. You're right. Saying your intuitions or your feelings about that case are different than when it's the actual brain. Can you explain what is a brain? 5-6 pounds? How can 5 or 6 pounds be so important? I mean, you know, the liver wouldn't be that important, would it? So say more.
Well, in a purer case of psychological switch where there wasn't any bodily continuity at all,
mm-hmm.
My sympathies would still go with the psychology. I don't think the case can be made very convincingly that on personal identity grounds that person who gets the psychology is the same person. But there's a separate question, which is the one that Parfit brought out in the article I mentioned, the question about what matters to you in your selfish concern for your own survival. And in response to that question, it would be the continuation of my psychology.
I want to ask you a question about why this all matters in a certain sense. I mean, okay, so this personal identity stuff is filled with weird thought experiments and weird, I mean, there's the Zoe's piece at the top, all this stuff from the movie literature, all these weird brain transplant, person plant, body transplants, memory wipes and all that sort of stuff. Well, I mean, why really should I care about, well, you know, my intuitive judgments of when it's the same person or a different person. Why should we care about this stuff at all?
Well, there is two questions, really. Like, why should you care about your intuitive judgments about whether the same person has persisted? And this other question, what matters to you in your selfish concern for survival? And I think personally that the intuitive judgments are not all that interesting in the end about same person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for that reason that I wasn't all that interested in the traditional problem of personal identity before I read the 1971 Parfit article. By the way, at that same time, I was reading articles by Sidney Shoemaker and a philosopher named John Perry.
I've heard of
him. Also, those collectively really drew me into thinking that this really was a serious issue, having to do not with personal identity per se, but having to do with your most basic selfish values.
So basically, if I get you right, on the question of what we should care about, you accept a fairly pure psychological criterion. And then in the Star Trek case, you might say, well, I mean, suppose that Colonel What's-His-Face knows beforehand that he's going to split.
Right.
Maybe he won't be officially identical with either of these successors,
right.
But psychologically, he ought to look out for them. So you think maybe the bodily criterion or maybe the brain criterion is right with respect to the official philosophical question, but with respect to the more interesting question that Parfit inspired you to think about, who should we care about? A more purely right. psychological theory is okay. Have I got you right?
Well, I
not quite.
I don't think that there probably is a correct answer to the personal identity issue.
Uh-huh.
So I doubt if either the bodily or the psychological criterion is correct per se. The other question, there may not be a univocal answer for everybody. I doubt if there is. But for many people, at any rate, psychological continuity looms larger in their concerns than bodily continuity without the psychology.
Suppose you were just to give you an example from, go back to the Star Trek The Next Generation. Suppose you were like Commander Riker and you encountered your double, right, who was right. on another planet. Suppose you knew that was going to happen at a future date. You were going to be doubled. Should you care? They're both psychologically continuous with you, and I don't quite understand how the transporter works, but I guess they're both bodily continuous with you. So you're planning for it, and you're going to have a split that happens on day 10. Should you plan for each of those futures? You know, the one where you're going to be down on the planet and the one where you're going to go gallivanting about the universe? Equally? Should you care equally about them?
Provided my fission descendants didn't have to share my meager salary, I would actually welcome that development.
So this opens a new a religious possibility, right? Instead of having purgatory, as in the official Roman Catholic Church, or maybe not in the official Roman Catholic Church, but at least my grandmother believed in it, you could just create two of you, and Raymond Martin, the bad guy, could go to hell, and Raymond Martin, the good guy, could go to heaven.
Let's see what some callers think here. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917, or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And Dave is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dave in San Francisco.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know, one of the things you guys hadn't really talked on yet that I wanted to bring in was, like, the cultural aspect to it. Back to the how Hollywood has kind of dealt with this issue before. Back in the 60s, I seem to remember a movie called The Watermelon Man, where a white man, by, like, some accident, becomes black. And he's essentially the same person inside, but the culture's reaction to him changes in such a way that by the end of the movie he becomes almost a Bobby Seale kind of Black Panther.
Yeah.
By the end. And you know, and kind of also cutting into that is also the transsexual, you know, transgender how men are treated differently than women and how women are treated differently in different cultures. You know, I think that the outside looking in at us has a lot to do with expectations.
Dave, I think you've got a good point. Thanks so much for the call. And Ray, what's your reaction? I mean, you know, we view different things as essential to ourselves. Such things such that if those changed, it wouldn't be me. If my race changed, would it really be me? If my gender changed, would it really be me? What do you think about thoughts like that? And where do those thoughts about what's essential come from?
Well, what's crucial, I think, when a person's contemplating some future dramatic change of that sort is whether they feel they can anticipate having the experiences of the person who has undergone that change. So some people might feel that if they were transformed into somebody that was racially different or sexually different, that they couldn't anticipate having the experiences of that person just because of those differences. I personally don't think I would feel that way. There's no question, though, but that the culture would treat you differently and your life would become extraordinarily different after the change.
So we'd have a continuum cases. One you might be transplanted into the body of, say, your identical twin. That probably wouldn't
right.
be too big a challenge. Then we have
right.
the kind of the transracial that we've already imagined, although it's interesting, in contrast to the 60s, we didn't really emphasize that too much. It was the Democrat-Republican that seemed more important. Then we might imagine, you know, say, transplanting Ken's brain into Meg Ryan's body.
Ooh.
And, you know, they'd probably take an extended period of self-exploration before he came to terms with that.
But we got more callers on the line. 1-800-525-9917. And Jennifer in Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jennifer.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to... I think about this a lot nowadays because my family is dealing with my mother who has Alzheimer's, and it just hits a lot close to home because she's definitely, you know, the same person because it's the same body and she looks the same, but her personality has completely changed. She used to be very joyful and funny and generous, and now the disease has progressed to the point at which she's just, you know, combative and frustrated and confused and angry all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we care for her because we love her, but she's not the same person. So for me, I mean, there's no question that identity goes with the psychological.
Jennifer, you said two different things. I want you to notice that. You said she's the same person, but she's undergoing all this stuff. She's not the same personality. Then toward the end of your remarks, you said she's definitely not the same person. So you sound conflicted to me about whether she's the same or different. Ray, what do you think about that conflict?
Well, in one sense, I mean, we do have sort of social criteria that are worked too. So what a person owns, the property they have, for instance, before they undergo some dramatic psychological change like Alzheimer's, remains their property afterwards. So as far as the society's concerned, the state's concerned, there is identity preserved. But in interpersonal relationships, like with a parent or something like that, my mother also had Alzheimer's before she died, there is a question that arises about whether the person you're interacting with is the same person you used to know. I mean, that's a very natural way of expressing that worry. And I'm inclined to agree with the caller that if enough of a person's psychology goes, then in most of the ways that matter from the point of view of interpersonal relationships at any rate, it's not the same person.
This is a tricky thing, because think about caring for an Alzheimer's patient and think about their wishes for themselves, right? And think about their previous wishes for their later selves. You say, if I get Alzheimer's and I, you know, can't reason for myself, I want you to treat me thusly. Right, they say that before they come down with severe Alzheimer's.
Right.
And then they come down with severe Alzheimer's, and they say, I don't want that. I want to lay in my own whatever, you know. Which person's wishes should you respect? The person who was looking forward and saying to you, when I get to that stage, treat me this way, or the person who's in that stage who refuses such treatment? What do you think?
Well, that's a complicated case because you made a promise to somebody, presumably before... Or you might have made a promise to somebody before they underwent the transition. So, I mean, if you made a promise to somebody to finish your own novel before they died, let's say, mm-hmm. you might feel an obligation to go ahead and finish the novel. Now, if somebody just expressed a wish and they didn't interact with you prior to expressing the wish, that after they undergo this transformation, they want to be treated in a certain way, then I think we also recognize a special sort of obligation, particularly to people we love, to respect their wishes about what happens after they die and after they're gone.
Yeah, but this person's still alive, and it's a different person. And I was trying to get you to tell me whose wishes, the earlier or the later. But let's let some...
earlier person.
Let some callers in here. Sydney in Redwood City's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sydney.
Hi there. I'm calling because one of the things I think is most important about identity is the process of individuation, you know, as you develop. I have two teenage daughters, and, you know, as they grow and become more themselves and presumably evolve over the course of their lifetime, I mean, that is the whole process of identity. And it just seems like that aspect of identity is, to me, more important than some of the things you've been discussing.
Yeah, well, I think in a way our guest agrees with you that the official question of who exactly is it maybe isn't so interesting as these kind of more psychological questions that usually but not always go with having the same person. And, you know, there's some related philosophical problems that you're getting into, like the problem of autonomy. What is it to have a self-concept that sustains a feeling of being free and making your own decisions? That's one of the things you want to develop with teenagers.
So what do you think, Ray?
Oh, I absolutely agree with what John just said, and also with what the caller said. These other issues are dealt with, of course, more by psychologists than philosophers, although to some extent by philosophers, too. But yes, we haven't been talking about them today.
But I want to push you a little bit more in this Alzheimer's case, because I think it's related to what our caller Sydney just had to say. Because you grow and develop, and there's a normal course of development, right? But sometimes things go wrong, and there's this psychological rupture. You have multiple personalities, you have fractured personalities, you lose the ability to consolidate short-term memory into long-term memory, so you can't have a continuous narrative of your life. But there's still that something like a person there, right? I just want to know how the past person and the future person, or the present person and the past person, are related in terms of their self-governance, autonomy, and stuff like that. Should we respect, the momentary person you are? Should we respect the person you were? I mean, help us think about that.
Well, I think you have to respect both of them to some extent. It depends also on the particulars of the case. Like in an Alzheimer's case, how badly off the person who has Alzheimer's becomes. At some point, you might not have very much respect for their judgments about all sorts of things. For instance, about whether or not they want to go ahead and live in their own traditional house, or whether they should be put in an assisted living facility. So something like that. At some point, a person might become incompetent or so divorced from their former self that you might not regard them as somebody whose wishes are somehow continuous with the person they used to be.
Right. So, I mean, my thought is that if we think deeply about what makes a person, then we can maybe illuminate some of these issues about autonomy and self-governance and all that. And that's why this stuff matters beyond these weird thought experiments. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing personal identity with Raymond Martin from Union College.
We've been talking about the nature of personal identity and the somewhat related but different question about the nature of the care we have for our future and past selves. We've talked about how we think about difficult cases, both real and imaginary. In our next segment, we'll consider the importance of identity for understanding morality and rationality.
Morality, rationality, and identity, when Philosophy Talk continues. Today's episode of Philosophy Talk is brought to you by Totem and Taboo by Sigmund Freud.
And how does that make you feel, Ken?
Like going to Powell's City of Books. Totem and Taboo, available online at powells.com.
Important is personal identity. I mean, we treat it as very important. We punish people for things they did years and years ago, 20 or 30 years ago, even if they've changed and you know, discovered religion and reformed while they were in prison. We plan for the people we will be 20, 30, 40, 50 years. We pass up a lot of fun in order to save for retirement for some old geezer that we wouldn't want to spend half an hour with. Is this all rational? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Raymond Martin from Union College.
Ray, personal identity is fundamental to our ordinary concepts of morality, responsibility, and rationality. Should it be?
That's a good question.
Only
I'm not
kind
sure.
We ask, Ray.
You know, the example that you mentioned earlier about somebody whose values change dramatically between the time they're a young person and the time they're an old person, if you anticipated that value change, you know, should you make sacrifices now to provide for the welfare of that future person? I think that if you were sure the values were going to change dramatically in ways that were abhorrent to you as a young person, it would be rationally and morally okay not to make special sacrifices for that future person, you know, beyond what you would make, say, for other people.
But that future person, our intuition is you, and it will be your values that change. And it will be, I mean, and in some sense, look, you start out as a kid, you go into an adolescent, you know, you've got all this weird rebellion and all this sort of stuff. Your parents say to you, you know, someday you will care about X, Y, or Z. Someday you will regret, you know, taking drugs, not studying, you know. So your values will change in a goodness-making way. Isn't it rational for the parents to say to the kid, think about the future that you will be and about the values that you will have, even though you don't have them now?
Yeah, but I mean, think. Here's a thought experiment for you, Ken. Suppose you're Bill O'Reilly, right? And you've got a big bank account, you know, a couple million dollars that you're saving to do with what you want when you're old. And a fortune teller tells you, Bill, you know, at about the age of 60, you're going to undergo a radical transformation and become a wishy-washy, wussy liberal. And then you're going to give all that money to the Democratic Party and the Dennis Kucinich campaign. Now, would it be rational for you as Bill O'Reilly to spend the money now so that guy won't have
it?
Well,
that's a good question. And so, Ray, what do you think? I mean, kid undergoing an evolution or Bill O'Reilly undergoing a sudden transformation, does it make a difference whether it's an evolution or a sudden transformation or what?
I think it matters how the changes happen. I actually had that worry when I was an undergraduate. A friend and I, we didn't have any money, so that wasn't the issue, but a friend and I were both Marxists. And so we were sitting in a coffee shop speculating upon what we would be like when we got to be older. And we decided that we would both be fairly successful people and make more money than we were making at the time, which was nothing.
So that was a tautology.
Yeah. And also being more successful and recognized, it would be a corrupting thing. And we would come to view our youthful Marxism as a kind of aberration, and that what we really wanted was to be more conservative. And so did we really care about those future people we were very likely to become? But we've imagined when I was an undergraduate that the changes would come about due to a corrupting process, a kind of inevitable corrupting process. And the funny thing is, and we also imagined that, well, when we're looking back from the point of view of our corrupted selves, will regard the transformations that were made as, you know, quite appropriate and okay and stuff. And the very thing happened to me, although I am a Dennis Kucinich fan, still I'm not a Marxist anymore. And so I did make that transition that I dreaded the thought of when I was a young guy.
So, I take your point that the nature of the transition matter. I take your point. I still think I'm still a bit puzzled, but let's let some callers in here. 1-800-525-9917, and Stephanie in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephanie.
Hi. I think this whole discussion has taken for granted that people are actually accurate and circumspect about their own identity. I think one of the biggest challenges I face out in the community is being able to tell whether people are who they say they are, and as we well know, the best liars are the ones that are lying to themselves first and then everybody else second. So,
Well,
how do you like that?
Stephanie, I think you got a point about, well, let's call it self-presentation. The self that we present to others, right? It may be bad faith, self-deception, all kinds of stuff. Self-presentation is loaded with all that sort of stuff. But does the self that you present yourself as, the self-presentation, really, Ray, determine your identity? I mean, that's a psychological sense that John was talking about, but in a metaphysical sense. Well, I mean, what's a self-presentation? Stephanie, I want Ray to, what does self-presentation have to do with, you know, who I am in this metaphysical sense?
Yeah, I would think that probably it doesn't cut down all the way to the metaphysical level. It's extraordinarily important for practical purposes and in self-development that a person understand what their values are and what their preferences are and so on. A lot of people get that wrong, and ultimately then they may change their mind about it.
Could you get that so wrong that it somehow cuts deeply into, like, what you really are, you know, kind of thing?
Well, people get it wrong about their sexual identities, for instance. Mm-hmm. So they think they're heterosexual and they're really homosexual or something like that.
Anybody in particular in mind? I mean...
No, I didn't have anybody in mind, but there are... Okay. And people also, you know, make other kinds of changes that are... Or the other kinds of discoveries about themselves, you know, that result in dramatic changes in their lives. To the point where they might rewrite their biographies. In fact, I think social scientists have investigated this biography, self-biography kind of phenomenon. And when people undergo a conversion experience of some sort or a revelation about their deepest motives that was startling and life-changing, they rewrite their narratives, personal narratives about themselves, so that different things get stressed. And
So Stephanie, thanks for the call. You raised a deep point. We've got one last caller in the line who also thinks we're missing something. Nick in Richmond. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Nick.
Hi, thanks for the call. Yeah, I think the basic assumption underlying a lot of your thought problems, like the mind, the brain-body switch you're talking about, makes the air of a dualism, that the psychology or the self is somehow distinct from the body that carries it around, as opposed to a more integrated view, which would say, well, I am a product of my body. And as someone mentioned, if I had a liver transplant in some significant way, I would become a different person. That you can't, you know, drive this. I mean, we do it all the time. It's human nature to construct a self, but it is a construct. And as your guest just said, we have to be very aware of the kinds of constructs we make. But at some deep level, we have to say that that we invent agency. We invent a self because it helps us function in the world and it helps maintain social order.
Thanks, Nick. What do you think, Ray?
Well, under normal circumstances, the various components of the part that we, or the self that we care about, go together. So our bodies, our psychologies, and so on, are all part of the same packages that proceed through time and change gradually, usually. In the philosophical thought experiments that have gotten the most discussion, of course, these parts come apart. So there is a kind of dualistic concern, perhaps, that raises its issue then, whether or not the parts that got separated are of equal importance, whether identity somehow goes with one of them but not with the others. So I basically agree with the reader, but I think that, or the caller rather, but I think that it's an inevitable consequence of considering the kind of thought experiments that philosophers consider.
Yeah, I think Nick has a good point, but we need to be a little careful about our terminology. What we've been involved in is what you might call brain-body dualism. That is thinking that, well, the brain really is got an importance to who we are, and that the rest of the body doesn't have. Now, somebody could be a brain-body dualist in that sense without being what's called a mind-body dualist, which is the idea that the mind is something separate from any part of the body. I don't think we've been involved in that too much.
You're right, but I do think we've also done another kind of dualism, kind of the software-hardware dualism. If you think of the brain as the hardware of the mind,
right.
But then there's this memories and stuff are kind of written in the software, and if you think, well, you could transplant those to a computer,
good point,
leaving the brain behind, right? But transplanting the memories, the perceptions, all that stuff to a different kind of hardware, the psychological criterion says it's the same person, right?
That's right.
And so there is, I think the caller does, there is a kind of dualism involved of some sort. I grant you, it's not Cartesian dualism, but there's a kind of dualism of some sort involved in all these thought experiments.
If our listeners want to read something about this that will strike them more as good literature than hokey philosophical science fiction, they can read Thomas Mann, The Transposed Heads.
Yeah. So, Ray, why don't you? I'll give you one last chance to comment on whatever you like as a closing thought. What's your closing thought?
Oh, my goodness. Well, this is a philosophical problem in the form that we've been considering it, which is different from these psychological issues, that's actually capable of being scary a little bit, unlike any other philosophical problem for me. And what's scary is that the thing under analysis is what's involved in moment-to-moment survival, not just survival into the future. And contemplation on the examples makes moment-to-moment survival seem much thinner and somehow less firm than intuitively we tend to think of it.
Well, Ray, on that thought, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Our guest has been Raymond Martin, professor of philosophy from Union College, author of The Rise and Fall of Soul and Self, An Intellectual History of Personal Identity. I love that title, John. That's a really nice title. So what did we learn? You knew all. John Perry is one of the leading thinkers about personal identity, folks, in case you didn't know, and he's written some really cool stuff. So you knew all about this stuff. Any new thoughts today?
Absolutely. Well, you know, about 15 years ago, I had one of these transformations like our self-deception person was talking about. I didn't discover that I was gay or black or something like that, but I discovered I was a type B person trapped in a type A job. And all these theories of personal identity really give me the theoretical equipment to deal with it. I could talk about for hours how that's possible.
Yeah,
and
I don't
still
know
be the same person. That's going to be a practical solution. I think retirement is the practical solution. But so there we are.
There you are. That's what we've learned today. But look, I mean, I find these issues really puzzling, and I don't really know what to think about this identity stuff. And Ray Martin was right about something, that Parfit article that got kind of a new wave of this going and still goes. I think that was very profound. And, you know, there could be two persons with your memory and two separate bodies. Each one has an equal claim to be you, but identity is... You can't be identical to two different things. So it's puzzling, but then you think, well, it's not identity. Who cares about identity? It's what we care about, and what should we care about? That's the real issue.
This issue, by the way, goes back at least to the Clark Collins debate back in the 1700s.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that.
Clark said, look, if your theory, Collins, who was a Lockean, is right about personal identity, there could be two of me in heaven, but then who would be me? And there's been a bit of literature about it, but Parfit made a bold move to separate two parts, and things haven't been the same since.
This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org.
For the final word, we turn to the artist formerly known as Ian Scholz, and come to think of it, he's still known as Ian Scholz, and he's also known as the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholz. So, personal identity. Who are you? Who am I? Can't say, but I do know for sure that a major part of human identity is based on cognitive dissonance, our ability to ignore information that conflicts with our beliefs, or troublesome facts that might prevent us from doing something we really, really want to do. The term was coined by social psychologist Leon Festinger after the publication of his book When Prophecy Fails in 1957. He had infiltrated a flying saucer doomsday cult whose leader had predicted the end of the world on a certain date. Well, that date passed and the world persisted, but most members' faith increased by accepting a new prophecy that the planet had been spared because of them. Cognitive dissonance is similar to another very human activity, wishful thinking, which can lead to both belief in God and highly unsatisfactory personal relationships. Wishful thinking may be one of the main reasons for the war in Iraq. The lack of evidence for weapons of mass destruction certainly provoked a form of cognitive dissonance. We can't find weapons of mass destruction, therefore Saddam Hussein has hidden them. Halt the cunning tyrant before it's too late. In thinking about cognitive dissonance and wishful thinking, I came across Moore's paradox. G.E. Moore was a friend of Bertrand Russell, mentor of sorts to Ludwig Wittgenstein, and his paradox was this. It's raining, but I don't believe it's raining. Thinking about this statement can be a real mind-bender. Can you know that it's raining and not believe it at the same time? But after a while, it starts to make sense. You realize that people do this all the time. Just the other day, I found myself saying about a movie, I liked it, but I didn't like it. And the person I was talking to not only seemed to know what I was talking about, but agreed with me. Agreed to what? Women are especially good at this. They can like their shoes and hate them at the same time, for instance. But the true sense of it's raining, but I don't believe it's raining, was brought home to me when I read a blog discussing the paradox, and one of the commenters made the statement, I live in Las Vegas, but I don't live in Las Vegas. I immediately understood what he meant. He lived in the real suburban cluster Las Vegas, not the casino Las Vegas. So the statement, it's raining, but I don't believe it's raining, could mean, it's raining, but you call that rain? When I was a boy, we didn't call it rain until the houses were floating away. Or, it's raining, but I choose to live in an imaginary land of sunshine and lollipops. Show business is ripe with this paradox. Actors frequently work as waiters, right? I'm a waiter, but I'm not a waiter. How many people doing one thing indulge in the wishful thinking that they will soon be doing something else? I once had a doctor in Hollywood give me his acting resume. I once had a waitress talk to me enthusiastically about the website she wanted to design. It's a syndrome common to showbiz, the web biz, and the entrepreneurial world in general. I call it the what you see me doing isn't what I do syndrome. Again, I am not immune. I lived in Los Angeles for a brief period in the 90s and had the thought pretty much every day. I live in L.A., but I don't live in L.A. It was this cognitive dissonance that eventually made me decide to return to San Francisco. So, yeah, I left L.A. But can anyone really leave L.A.? I gotta go.
Ian Shows, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Daniel Elstein, Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, and Mark Stone.
Philosophy Talk is sponsored in part by Powell City of Books, on the web at powells.com. Support also comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.